This is an ABC podcast.
Today we hear why a growing number of Australian families are handing over huge amounts of money for overseas stem cell treatments.
If you are in our position, you would do anything for your child, and especially if you see success stories. So there are no guarantees, not with any medical treatment, but what we want is that we want to have a choice.
And the work of female Indigenous rangers in protecting sacred women's sites from becoming sick country.
I feel being a woman ranger, it's more to do on my country. So I know that I could work on my country and look after my country better than, you know, anyone else, I guess.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. It sounds like a case of deja vu for the mining industry, with Peakbody, the Australian Mining and Metals Association, forecasting that close to 21,000 new mining workers will be needed over the next 4 years. WA alone is forecast to need over 10,000 new workers for 30 big projects. The report is the first since the Labor government's attempt to forecast employment in mining with the National Resources Sector Employment Task Force report, which was released back in 2010. The authors of this new report are calling on the government and business to avoid what it sees as a looming skills shortage, not seen since the days of the mining construction boom. Director of Operations Tara Diamond explains to Alex Hyman that this forecast was quite conservative, as it only considered committed or advanced mining projects.
What we felt was very important is that companies know what they're working on, but having a national picture, and we haven't had this sort of national picture for 10 or 11 years, it gives not only the companies a sense of the landscape of when other operations are going to be coming online, but it gives the community and all stakeholders a view of the landscape. So it enables, governments, it enables education, whether it be tertiary or vet, even high schools, the opportunity to really provide people who are interested in the industry a transparent view of when the workforce is required.
Following the last downturn in the mining industry, some people moved out of the industry. They moved back to wherever they came from, within Australia or perhaps even overseas, and moved on to other things. Are you hopeful that you can get some of them back into the industry, or is it a case of once bitten, twice shy, and they may be scared off somewhat?
It's a really good point, because, you know, there was a lot of challenges with the super cycle, you know, particularly in places like WA. A lot of people either moved or did FIFO from the East Coast to be able to fulfill those roles. And, you know, it was quite a steep, you know, decline once the cycle had come off. And so, you know, it's absolutely right to categorise that as a really challenging time that some people, may be more cautious. But I think it's also really important to remember that these roles are highly technical. You know, the average weekly salaries in resources is between $1,350 and $2,650. And many of the roles are much, much higher than that. So there's a real economic opportunity, not just for the communities and the states, but also for people to think about their career in terms of what opportunities are available to them. And then to also recognise that resources is cyclical, but we are seeing a much steadier growth than we did in the previous cycle of when projects are coming online.
4 years, 21,000 roles within the mining industry, some new workers that are required. What can government and business do to meet that demand? And what would you like to see happen over those next 4 years to make sure that those projects can fill those roles that are required?
I think it's really important to talk to the communities, talk to the educational institutions. You know, what we've seen is that some parents and indeed universities have been persuading students not to go into some of the disciplines that are so important, like mining engineering, into this. So we would really use this report as a flag to say that these are very real careers, not just in here in Australia, but overseas.
And just finally, if we don't meet this demand, could we see some mine projects delayed?
I think that there's enough foresight on the projects that we have. It does probably put a lot of pressure on the supply chain in terms of the contractors as well, you know, whether it be engineering contracting, whether it be equipment contracting. But we really think that the steadiness of the profile of the projects and the workforce that are required, we really think that that we as an industry here in Australia will be able to rise to the challenge.
Tara Diamond of the Australian Mining and Metals Association there.
ABC Australia Wide.
I think it's wonderful. I think everyone should come and see it.
On ABC Radio.
Joyce Boehm's country is in one of the most remote parts of Australia, central Arnhem Land. After her mum got sick, she was inspired to go home and become a female ranger.
Now I just want to go fulfill her dreams, and I want to be out there and be like my mum. And look after the land, look after the country, take my kids back there.
Joyce Boehm is one of the many Indigenous female rangers employed across Australia. The Indigenous ranger workforce has traditionally been male-dominated, but since 2011, there's been a targeted strategy to encourage more women to work on country. By introducing more flexible work arrangements, now women make up a third of the workforce. Tina Yagana works with ranger groups in central Arnhem Land. She says it's vital women are involved in caring for their environment.
Part of cultural responsibilities is that men and women have similar and also separate authority to look after country. And one of them is this sacred sites and rock art sites that are special to women. So if there are no women rangers, then those areas aren't able to be accessed by men. And so it becomes empty country, and many women feel that then that country might become sick.
In some places, it's not culturally appropriate for Indigenous men and women to work alongside each other. Ms. Yagana says without a female workforce, this means sacred women's sites can become neglected, having devastating effects on the environment.
One of the challenges that are now being faced by ranger groups regarding empty country is fire management. So when there is nobody living on the homelands, then the impact of weed species on the change of fire regimes means that there's now hotter fires and more chance of wildfires in the late dry season.
So by having more female rangers that's their area, that's their home country that they're going to look after, you could see that improving the fire management.
Yes, and fire management also impacts the protection of sacred sites as well, because if there aren't protective burning around rock art sites and sacred sites, then there is a chance of those sites being lost over time. So fire, feral animals rubbing up against rock art sites, and even flooding and the wet season. So there is a significant impact of empty country on keeping those cultural sites alive.
Tina Yagana of Mimal Land Management.
Everybody got their shirts and stuff, so power tools will split all the ranger groups in two.
In the Kimberley region of Western Australia, female rangers are gathering at the spectacular Winjana Gorge. They are from 8 ranger teams from different language groups. Together, they handle everything from fire management to feral animal control to researching and protecting vulnerable species and cultural sites. Mother of 3, Davina Cox, jokes with Claire Moody that if she was not working as a ranger, she probably would be sitting at home watching Netflix.
All depends on the area, I suppose. We have the perspective of the culture where women areas kept for women's site and the men's site for men's site. In our in our ranger groups, we work alongside with our men. We basically share the load of work together, which is really good.
You do the same work, essentially?
Yes.
Yeah.
Try and get them out to do the seed collecting. That's a bit hard. So they just leave that up to us girls.
One of the biggest challenges facing female ranger teams is getting long-term funding locked in. Chantelle Murray is a coordinator for the Nurrara Women Ranger Group in the Great Sandy Desert.
So we want these sisters, these mothers, these all our family out there as women, wanting to be woman rangers, to become woman rangers. The only thing is holding us up, holding us back is funding.
Up in the territory, Joyce Boehm says becoming a female ranger is not just about the job or the money.
I feel being a woman ranger, it's more to do on my country. So I know that I could work on my country and look after my country better than, you know, anyone else, I guess.
Joyce Boehm there from Central Arnhem Land.
ABC Australia Wide.
If you listen really, really hard to the wind that's blowing, you can hear the voices and there's a peace come over you.
On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. It's an age-old adage that a parent would do anything for their child. But when doing everything involves wandering into the terrain of unproven medical treatment, the circumstances are much less straightforward. In Cairns, single mother Doreen Deed is about to embark on one of these journeys. And as she's been explaining to our reporter, Jessie Thompson, the reasons behind her decision are far from simple.
Yeah, so I'm here at the marina to collect bottles and cans that are being collected for us for our fundraising.
This is a typical Monday morning for Doreen Deed. Loading a huge metal cage into the back of her minivan, filling it with recyclables that have been emptied over the weekend, and later cashing them in at a depot. For months, the single mother has been pulling out every last stop as she tries to raise about $35,000. She's doing it all for treatments for her daughter, Emma.
Yes. Whee!
Emma is 9, but during birth, she almost suffocated. She lives with cerebral palsy and dystonia, and as she was growing up, it didn't take long before Miss Deed noticed significant issues with Emma's development.
And then that's when I decided that I wanted to be a mum that gives everything to my daughter. And that was a choice I made, and that choice included that I live for her, that I do everything in my power to give her all the chances that she can get to one day live independently. And
it's part of what's driving them from Cairns to the United States this week, where Emma will receive stem cell therapy via 2 lumbar punctures from a private clinic in Chicago. The treatment is expensive. It isn't clinically proven.
That is the one side. But then if you are a mum like me, wouldn't you try everything? So this treatment has been offered around the world for many, many years. So it is just not legal in Australia right now. So I'm confident that one day it will be available in Australia and it will be deemed safe.
For now, she's prepared to take that risk. In fact, they're part of a community of parents investigating the potential that overseas stem cell treatments could offer to various medical disorders, mainly neurological ones. This practice is sometimes known as stem cell tourism, and researchers say just as this community is growing, so too is the number of private, international clinics willing to sell these families hope.
We get perhaps an inquiry once a day from someone looking for information, and I think what our responsibility is as a research community is to try to contextualise the science. And unfortunately, that means that most of those conversations start with a disclaimer that we don't have any proven treatments for that condition.
Megan Munsey is an associate professor from the University of Melbourne, and she's watched as these clinics have proliferated, increasingly in Western countries too. Part of her job is to negotiate the sometimes significant gap between the seemingly miraculous interventions that these clinics offer and what their patients actually receive.
One of my biggest challenges in this field, I think, is the fact that stem cells are somehow seen as magical. And really, I think these complex conditions that one day we hope we have new therapies for are going to require sophisticated solutions. And hopefully stem cells, for some conditions, will play a role. But for others, they may not.
Is it also quite risky for people taking up these treatments because, just by nature, so many of them are quite invasive medical treatments?
It's a really great point. The fact that the cells have to be delivered into the body through some way should be a really important consideration. And I think, again, that's what gets lost. It's often downplayed on the website and the advertising material. But I also worry that it's not fully considered by the people who are pursuing the treatment.
Associate Professor Munsey says there should be more information for families in these situations. Elsewhere, the push is for more onshore clinical trials. An Australian first trial, run by the Murdoch Children's Institute in Melbourne, is underway, and the 12 places it offered were highly coveted. Dr. Megan Finch-Edmondson, a senior stem cell research fellow with the Cerebral Palsy Alliance, has been watching the trial closely. She's also been advocating for more in the future.
We absolutely know that, you know, many Australian families are making that difficult decision to travel overseas to access cell therapy treatments that are not currently available in Australia. And that is one of the reasons that we are so committed to really trying to progress this research and conduct more rigorous clinical trials in Australia. It does require those, very rigorous clinical trials that can show enough data to those regulatory bodies to warrant that this treatment should be available. And that's absolutely what we are, you know, working towards and pushing for. But we just need, you know, we still do need more data in that space.
But until that long process draws to an end, families like Miss Deeds may continue to look overseas for help.
And a lot of families feel that the choice is being taken away from them. And as I said, if you are in our position, you would do anything for your child, and especially if you see success stories. So there are no guarantees, not with any medical treatment, but what we want is that we want to have a choice in what treatment we seek.
Doreen Deed there speaking to Jesse Thompson. Scientists in far north Queensland fear a rainforest has become more flammable than the surrounding grassland after it was hit by a cyclone earlier this year. Fires have been contained in the Iron Range in Cape York after helicopters were called in to waterbomb the fast-moving blaze last week. But there's still plenty of dried-out timber on the ground, leaving concerns there could be more to come. Eric Barker reports.
The 2019 fire season has been at the front of mind in the Indigenous community of Lockhart River. The town and the surrounding Iron Range rainforest in the Kutini Payemu National Park was decimated by Cyclone Trevor in March, leaving piles of drying out timber lying on the ground. But the worst fears have started to come true, with fires taking hold in early September.
To me, it seems like severe punch to an ecosystem that was already down.
Gabrielle Davidson is an ecologist who runs a research station in the Iron Range. She says fires are a yearly occurrence in the area, and the rainforest normally acts as a natural break, as the closed canopy blocks out the sunshine and keeps in the moisture. But that's not the case this year, as the rainforest is now adding to the fuel.
I have always known that this season was going to be a terrible one, but I had no idea that it was going to be this bad. We're in a situation up here where the grass won't burn in some cases and the forest will. So we have a rainforest that's more flammable than savanna, which is absolutely insane.
Like Gabrielle Davidson, Professor Steve Turton says the fire reaching the rainforest is concerning. He studied the impacts of other large disturbances like Cyclone Dari and Yasi, which hit the Daintree rainforest further south. He says despite the destruction, the chances of regeneration are high.
It depends just how much the soil seed bank is still there. Normally the soils are good insulators even with fire, so the fire goes over the top and it remains fairly cool beneath that insulated layer, and that allows things to come up when the rain comes. So overall, though, because there are patches of remaining forest in the region nearby that are providing healthy sources of rainforest fruit, I'd say the chances of recovery are very high.
Like the trees, animals are still struggling to survive. The Iron Range is home to a number of endemic species, like the palm cockatoo, eclectus parrot and the green tree python. Gabrielle Davidson says their reaction to the fires has been mixed.
Look, it's been pretty quiet. I had really hoped that it was going to be a case of small sections burnt and a lot of sections left. But in my aerial survey of it yesterday morning, it seemed that while there was some patches that were like that, we must have had a couple of days there where it just went through everything. It's burnt out the bottoms of the valleys. It's burnt out the tops of the hills. The ground is like snow. There's just nothing on it. There's just isolated large trees standing all black. And that is not a situation that a green tree python can get away from. The birds are in a better position, of course, and I know from my observations after the cyclone that they left and came back, but there's less habitat for them to come back to.
Gabrielle Davidson from the remote Iron Range Research Station, finishing that story by Eric Barker. And Queensland Fire and Emergency Services and Queensland Parks and Wildlife are continuing to monitor those fires. A unique program being run by Karratha Police in the Pilbara in Western Australia is opening up a whole new world to at-risk kids. The Australian First program is teaching scuba diving to try and get kids more engaged in school and their futures. Karen Mitchell-Moore has more.
It's a big day for a group of Karratha students from the Clontarf Academy. They're about to have their first ocean dive in the beautiful, clear, cool blue water at Whitnall Bay on the Burrup Peninsula. Mason is 14.
Hoping to see some sharks, fish and just coral. And it's like basic, you know, just everything out there.
Yeah. I guess this is what all those past weeks has been about.
Yeah. I think I'm pretty prepared for it. I don't think I had any trouble learning all the stuff, but yeah, I'm pretty excited.
Yeah,
I'll
be okay. The dinner. Thank you. Put it all the way on and then one down.
It's been quite the journey to get to this point. Until a few weeks ago, some of the students didn't even know what scuba diving was.
I didn't really know what scuba diving was like, all about it until now.
Karratha Youth Crime Intervention Officer Andy Goddard came up with the idea about 6 months ago. He was a dive instructor for many years before arriving in the Pilbara.
The kids from our police and direction are kids really that have probably, should we say, lost a little bit of their way in life. So we're trying to get engaged primarily back into school.
In the lead up to the ocean dive, the kids have spent hours in the classroom learning the theory and in the local swimming pool learning the skills.
It's only the third time he's putting his gear together, so I'm very impressed. It's like he's been doing it for months.
I caught up with them at their third lesson in the pool 3 weeks ago.
Yaw regulator and watch your gauge to make sure there's no needle fluctuation. So, yeah, you want to make sure there's no fluctuation in the needle when you breathe.
Natalie Callanan from Pilbara Dive and Tours has been instructing the boys. She's been diving for 25 years and learned as a teenager herself. She believes the program will be successful because it's something completely out of the box.
I think it will work because we've given the boys something else to focus on. So this is a whole new area of them. They've never done it before. They probably never even thought about doing it before. And so I think we're giving them something new to focus on. And hopefully if we can, you know, garner their interest, we can keep them going forward with diving, progressing through the different dive levels and maybe even into the workforce.
Andy Goddard says he's seen an amazing change in the boys.
The development in the boys has been amazing, actually. They've realised, you know, how much diving can really push them, but they've been up to the challenge and they've achieved a lot. I'd say the change, a major change, is in their confidence. Taking it into the outside world, it's really a lesson of, you know, if you don't succeed the first time, try again and you will get there. And that's really the message that we're trying to instil into the boys, that, you know, life isn't sometimes that easy, but if you can put some effort into it, you can achieve great results.
Finally, the big day arrives. So tell me about that experience.
Cold. Oh, but and really fun though, like seeing all the coral life and fishes, just staying underwater for longer, so it's good to see more than that, yeah.
It's a great pleasure to present the awards to the inaugural graduates of the dive program.
Pilbara Superintendent Paul Coombs is on the beach to congratulate the boys on their achievement.
And I know your families will be very proud of you, as we are, and hopefully this will lead on to bigger and better things.
There's been avid interest in their progress from across Australia, from other organisations and towns wanting to try the program themselves.
Well done, man.
Well done, mate. Good job. Another superstar as well. Again, we'll have the qualified diver. Well done, mate.
Cool, mate.
Yeah.
Fantastic. That's Karen Mitchamore with that report. For everything about the Australian culture of pools, including billabongs, ocean baths, backyard pools or the local swim centre, tune into ABC TV and iView at 7:40 on September 22nd and 29th, or you can go to abc.net.au/thepool if you can remember all that. And that's it for Australia Wide for this evening. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.